your greatest responsibility is to be open to all the ideas that other people have, but also to hang on for dear life to the things you think are good about the show, and which through the journey you've been on with it in the edit.
And it's huge gratitude, I think, to be kind of at that end of to being kind of responsible for really putting it together and respecting everything that came before it.
Making the story better for what you've done, but not making it the key thing in the whole show.
You should keep your ego in check with power. The best use of power is to empower other people, really.
Hello, everyone. On today's episode of the We Need to Talk About Ask Group podcast, I'm joined by two super talented editors, Paolo Pandolfo and Peter Lambert, who have worked on wonderful films like The Death of Stalin or The Personal History of David Copperfield, and amazing shows like The Crown or Teen Star. And of course, we have a very good reason to sit down and talk today about a little limited series titled The Regime, directed by Stephen Frears and Jessica Hobbs, written by Will Tracy and starring Kate Winslet, Matthias Schoenaert, Andrea Riseborough, Hugh Grant, Martha Plimpton, and the list goes on. Pete, Paolo, welcome to the show. How's it going?
Great. Well, thank you very much for having us.
We usually like to ask our guests about their core memories that either made them fall in love with films in general or made them go, yes, I got it, I'm going to be a filmmaker. Do you have a moment or time / period in your life which you can attribute one of these feelings to?
Pete, do you want to go first?
Okay, yeah, I do. I left school at the age of 18, very excited by theatre. And I wanted to be a theatre director at that stage. And I went to university and I found myself studying drama. But while I was there, I, for various reasons, got less excited by theatre. And I found myself attending film studies classes where all kinds of different films were shown. And they were discussed in very, very serious, thoughtful ways. And the idea to me that films could be something more than just something I would enjoy with friends at the weekend or on a video at home, but actually be something you would take seriously, was surprisingly quite a new one and a very, very exciting one. And over the course of a 3-year degree, I found myself sort of dropping anything to do with theatre and focusing more and more on films, watching films, but also starting to try and make short films, which were, of course, dreadful. And I edited stuff on Super 16 millimeter film, but I also edited stuff on tape-to-tape systems, hitting play on one VHS player and record it on another to try and lay down a series of shots. And I found that editing was exciting to me. And it was that time in life where suddenly a door opens and you get very, very excited by something and the possibility that it might be something you could spend the rest of your life doing. Although it seemed, you know, frighteningly difficult, it was also very exciting. So that was the time for me.
For me, I think it was sort of two moments, I think, that were kind of big in my story, falling in love with film. The first one was watching Jurassic Park when I was around 8, I think, when it came out. And I just fell in love with how it made me feel, essentially. Wow. The kind of the power of and the magic of that. And obviously, I didn't understand how it worked, what was behind that. But I'd always liked watching movies, but that was kind of the first time that I guess, really started wanting to understand what actually went into making something like that, because it just made me feel so completely in awe of what I was watching. And then, so that was kind of a defining moment for me. And then I started, like many kids do, I think, started kind of making films as very young, you know, at the time VHS as well. And in my early teenage years, I also kind of discovered editing, doing tape to tape as well, kind of VHS to VHS, because it was kind of the next stage in the development of my terrible, you know, little films that I would make with my friends. But I wanted to kind of shoot them out of order. I started, you know, it was a kind of a progression. And how do I do that? Started kind of understanding about film. And then not long after that, kind of the first kind of nonlinear stuff, like, you know, consumer nonlinear software started coming in. And then, you know, I started kind of making the transition into that. But it was quite early for me in the sense I never really considered really kind of doing anything else. So I don't know. I wanted to be a director. I wanted to be a writer, all of that stuff. And then I very quickly, when I started making more like bigger short films and things like that, I kind of realized that the thing that I actually loved about it was the editing and not the being on set and not any, or not writing and or anything like that. The thing that actually gave me more pleasure was the kind of private bit afterwards and putting the story together. Sets really terrified me when they became something a little bit more serious than the tiny film, you know. And that was sort of it.
Collaborating, working closely together has always fascinated me. And you told me before the interview that you really did work pretty closely together while editing The Regime. And you edited half and half of the show, which means three episodes. If I'm not wrong, Paolo, you edited episode number 3, 5, and 6, while you Pete worked on 1, 2, and 4.
That's right.
And this adds up to somewhere between 2.5-3 hours for each of you. How did you split the episodes, the work, and how do you decide on who gets to edit what?
It was simpler than you might think, in that really the decision had already been made before Paolo and I came on board, which was to do with how the episodes were divided by the two different directors. So certainly by the time I met for the job, I was meeting with Stephen, because he at that stage didn't have an editor. And I'd already learned that he would be directing episodes 1, 2, and 4. And when I met Stephen, he told me that Jess and Paolo were going to be the other creative team, and they were going to be doing 3, 5, and 6. So actually, we didn't really have to think too hard about that, did we, Paolo?
No, not at all. but what was interesting was, because they're not, you know, it wasn't half and half in the sense that, you know, Pete didn't do 1, 2, and 3 and I did the end. Mm. There was an overlap. That was a sort of interesting thing for us to consider. But it wasn't, you know, we didn't really get a choice on that. I've worked with Jess for a very long time, almost 10 years now. So I came with her as a kind of a package. And then was very happy when I learned that Pete was going to be editing Stephen's episodes, because I've always been a great admirer of him and knew him, and for me just thought it was a great opportunity to work closely with someone, you know, like him. It was very cool.
What was interesting to me was that, I don't know how typical this is, but all 6 episodes were shot over the same stretch of time. And so one day a bit of episode 1 might be shot and a bit of episode 5 might be shot, and another day a bit of episode 2 and a bit of episode 6. Some days it all happened to be one of Stephen's episodes. Some days it all happened to be one of Jess's episodes. And those were always nice for me, the day after, because I'd have a day to catch up on anything I was behind on. But it was really interesting, because all the time you were getting in material that you knew you were going to be digging very deeply into, but you were also seeing other stuff coming in from a sort of slightly different perspective. And we were, you know, assembling things in tandem the whole time, which was fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of unusual for TV to happen like that, because it's usually kind of split in blocks, which are dictated by the directors. They don't usually overlap. So you'd have a director shooting all their episodes in one go, and then another director will come in and shoot their block. So the overlap in shoot the whole way through, it was a 5-month shoot. It was a 5 months, I guess, was it?
Or, that sounds about right. Yeah.
It was very unusual for both directors to be on doing it for that amount of time. And therefore two editors parallel kind of assembling different stuff alone. So it was a slightly different process than I'd been used to in other shows, but that I really enjoyed. It made sense with the story being a self-contained story, being a kind of a limited series as well. Kind of, it was all written, ahead of time. We sort of all knew where it was going. It made sense for it to be made like that. But it was just great to be able to look at each other's stuff as we were going and go, oh man, can you look at the sequence? That's what I'm doing, and sort of see it kind of slowly being born.
So basically, thanks to this overlap, not just your department was the one that had to work together so closely, but generally the whole cast and crew.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think, would I be right in saying, Paolo, that really it was only in the directors and editors that there was any split in the series, right? Everyone else
That's right.
was working on all six.
That's right. Same so DOP.
Same DOP, Cave, the production designer, covering everything. And obviously, Will, the showrunner, lead writer, was over everything. And the same cast happened to be in all of it as well, which helped.
But yeah.
I mean, it could have been an anthology, so... And staying with collaborations, is keeping your artistic freedom during this process possible, or is it even among the goals? Is that an option, or that's not where your focus is in a scenario like this, rather making the final product as coherent as possible?
I think it's a very organic thing, though, that, one thing kind of doesn't necessarily, it doesn't feel like that anyway, that you're abdicating a creative vision at any point, I don't think, because you're doing it with someone else. Obviously, the directors lead the way in terms of the tone and the vision for it, and there's loads of discussions and, planning that they do. But in terms of editing, I think... I never felt like I was giving up a language or something because of how Pete was working. And I hope that didn't happen vice versa. It was kind of an organic thing.
Absolutely not. And I think as an editor, I think if you went into a job thinking, I'm here to express my artistic vision and that is of paramount importance, that's going to go wrong. But that's probably not going to go well. But likewise, I think if you're working and you feel like your ideas, your taste, your own sensitivity is not being recognized, that's also going to go wrong. This was one of those jobs where those two things aligned really well. But your job as an editor, I think, for the most part, for most editors anyway, is to be sensitive to the material and to find a editing style and cutting rhythms and so on, which are appropriate to the material, to the rushes that you're working with. And in doing that, I do think, strangely enough, you very often do find an outlet for your own self-expression in that process. And that's what happened on this show for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. I think that's a really brilliant way of putting it.
Thank you, Paolo.
This perfectly shows you two's dynamic. So.
we're not this polite when we're in the cutting rooms.
So if the show works, here's the reason.
Yeah, I mean, no. I was really lucky in that I had a director in Stephen Frears who is so brilliant and so experienced. And he has a really interesting way of directing in the edit, which does give you a lot of space to try things yourself. you know, while at the same time feeling like you're not personally responsible, and like there's no danger that you're going to make a dreadful mistake and send things down the wrong track, because as the director, he will always guide you in the right direction. So that was really a wonderful experience, and it did allow me to feel like I was constantly getting opportunities to try out my own ideas and to, I don't want to sort of say stamp my own creative personality on the work, because I don't think that's what you should be doing. But at the same time, I never felt like I was sort of doing anything which didn't feel organically right to the way I thought about the material.
You also told about how even though you edited half and half of the series, it isn't split perfectly, especially like this when you have to pick up after one another, and just in general. How do you adjust to the theme, the style of the project in general?
That's such a good question.
And specifically in the case of the regime, and I mean this in terms of tempo, rhythm, etc.
That's a brilliant question, which Paolo is going to answer.
So it was that good.
I can take a stab at it.
Again, it comes back to kind of being more organic than it sounds, because I think it's sort of during the process of putting it together, we are discovering things about the show. Everyone is discovering things about the show, and so are we as editors. And then when we start working with our directors in the fine cuts, we were very much discovering the show together. What was the tone of the show, the rhythm of the show and stuff, and sort of parallel to each other, you know, two editing rooms running parallel and sort of watching the cuts. We had the privilege, I guess, or of coming after that, the first two episodes. So we sort of, me and Jazz as a team, kind of could observe a lot of the organic process that was happening in episodes one and two, because we were sort of editing the show in order, and sort of filter that into episode three, which was the one that we were working on first. And what I mean by that is just in terms of tone and how much to push the comedy, what kind of music to use, the things that they were trying, you know, we were sort of observing through what they were doing and sort of filtering through our vision, but using a lot of what was coming from
I think to clarify, because that could imply that you were seeing what we were doing and reproducing it, actually that which wasn't the case at all. I think what was happening was, at times you would see things that we were trying, sometimes which weren't necessarily landing properly as we were trying to find the tone of the show, or were sort of going in a particular place but not fully pointing towards something but not reaching it. Mm-hmm. And you were able to see things that were, you know, from the work we were doing, you would say, okay, this direction might not work, but then you guys would be like, okay, so how about we try this?
Yeah.
And so very often there were stages when you guys would find a solution to something which we had been struggling with, and then we'd come and look at what you were doing and go, oh, that's really interesting. You know, like, wouldn't you say that's true, Paolo?
Yeah, it's sort of filtered into the other, you know, in a way.
Yeah, it was a bit like we were sort of on two little teams of travelers setting off from the same place and aiming for the same, you know, the same destination, but taking slightly different paths and shouting out to each other on the way, hey, this seems to work. And from time to time, you know, I would be battling a monster. Me and Stephen would be fighting a monster, and Jess and Paolo would seem to have found a kind of a smoother path. And other times, Jess and Paolo would be drowning in the rapids, and we'd be getting there more easily. And sometimes we were all in trouble. But, you know, when we found solutions for our own episodes, they very often informed what the other team would be doing, I think. And that was definitely most true in terms of tone and pace and that sort of thing.
It's true. But also, I think that's very true. And it's also what I said before about the vision of the directors, who were very much working as collaborators from way before we kind of got any material and kind of started putting things together. That there was a coherent vision for the show, you know, that was established by the writing and by the directors and by the actors and by the choices that they made. So that was very kind of solid ground to stand on for us already.
Throughout the show, the audience can follow how the tide changes during Elena's reign. What are your options? Is there any way for you to help induce this process, the feeling of change coming and taking place and getting this whole feeling through to the audience?
Yeah, I think that was one of the biggest kind of job preoccupations of ours in the edit, was just mapping out, making sure that in the way we edited it, the journey which had already been written, obviously, and shot, what was laid out as coherently as possible. And we had an enormous amount of options for that. It's a complicated show, just in terms of the story. You know, as I'm sure you're aware, that there's an awful lot of balls to keep in the air. And there's, you know, because right from the start, the audience is landed in a show which takes place without any explanation in a fictional country that exists now, where people speak English, but with a variety of different accents, where some things from our world exist, like CNN and American Senate Foreign Relations Committee in the White House, and Chinese infrastructure and cobalt mining. But some things which get talked about, like the Fabian Corridor, or I don't know what else, Keplinger, are completely new terms. And the audience has to work hard in order to keep up with those things, which is obviously, when you get it right, is very exciting and very compelling for an audience and very flattering to their intelligence. It sucks you in because you have to work at it as an audience member to try and to make sure you're keeping up. But if you get it wrong and the audience doesn't feel like they have quite enough information, you can find that people start feeling like they've missed something, they feel insecure, they feel like they're not keeping up and they should be. Ought I to know who Keplinger is? Should I know what the Westgate sugar beet industry is for me to enjoy this? And then people can get distracted and frustrated by it. And a large part of the journey of where Elena goes from at the start of the show to where she ends up at the end of the show, on very practical terms, is just about sort of blocking out those sort of things, you know, all these different story strands. And a big part of the edit was just working out when we wanted to clarify things, when it was better to not clarify things, and just make sure that the audience, we try to get to a place where the audience feels just comfortable enough with the journey that they're going on. Very long answer. Paolo, do you agree?
No, I completely agree. I think there was one for me, as you said, the biggest challenge was the world building, in a sense, the sort of plot mechanics of it. But for me, there was something that was very anchored in the show from the moment I read it, which was the love story, which was the relationship between the two characters. And for me, that was always a sort of lighthouse that I could always look to. And even when it's some elements seemed not to kind of, we were struggling to make work, or, you know, deciding how to construct, that was the one kind of solid thing that I, throughout every episode, I felt that we could always sort of go back to and that always track, I think. So for me, I always felt that as a kind of, as an anchor of the show, you know.
Yes, I remember you saying that during the shoot, and that was immensely helpful. And thinking, oh yeah, that's very reassuring. We've got that. And we should keep coming back to that. It was really great.
Yeah, it is hard. I mean, it's I don't know. For me, when I started seeing what Kate and Matthias were doing with it, and how the chemistry and how it came together, it was kind of a moment of going, ah, okay, this is amazing. if we, you know, if we, it's, if it's, it'll be harder to explain how the Fabian Corridor features in all of that, as you put it, and how the cobalt mines and how the dynamic of all of this, you know, all of this. But when they look at each other, I sort of understand what, you know, what they feel and how it develops and stuff. And I'm just very proud of that throughout the show when I watch it. I think I really latch onto them as characters. And I hope people do too.
This question is a bit more aimed towards you, Paolo, since you worked on the last two episodes. But I'm sure since you both had to oversee this on such a level that you have some insight on this as well, Pete. And I can honestly say that I managed to fall in love with the show really fast, or rather the show managed to make or get me fall in love with it really fast, quite possibly thanks to Kate Winslet. But to stick to the being honest part, at times I was like, okay, I'm vibing with this, but where exactly are we heading exactly? And then near the end of episode 5, all hell breaks loose, but we are left at a sort of, a cliffhanger where you are like, now I can't stop. And however, the first half of the final episode has some longer sequences, which were a bit of a surprise, but a welcome one. And then it really picks up the pace. So my question to you is, what was your approach when you had to execute this sudden change of pace? I mean, sure, there was a lead up to it, the suspense building, but still, I can't even remember the last time I've seen a show where the last episode switches up on this level, because so many limited series, basically the whole show is about this building and building suspense. Or building, obviously, the regime also builds towards that, but it's just ups the ante on such a level. That's a long question from me.
But I think it's a really interesting one. And I mean, that's one of the things that I really loved when I read it. I was like, oh my God, how lucky am I to be doing this? Because I think it gave the fact that we go out of the palace. I know in episode 4, she has the trip out to visit the factory. So we see a little bit of the outside world, but there is something sort of managed about that, you know, still. Because she's still in power, she still has control over things, in a sense. The preposition of episode 6 is her not having control over it and having to kind of come to reality, you know, come to accept the fact that she doesn't have control over things. And that removing us from the universe, the environment that we've been sort of like used to, I think kind of is key to the shift in pace, you know, even tone. But that was what was so fun about it. You know, Jazz Hobbs, who directed, had such a brilliant vision for it. And we sort of always talked about it feeling like a ride almost in a park, in an amusement park. I mean, it's like a roller coaster. You always got to be thrown to different.
It's the worst roller coaster ever.
But it's very cool because I've had some people that some of the people that started watching the show and I started getting this feedback, and even from, you know, the sound team that we were mixing at the moment, and they were talking about how they didn't know where the story was going to take them next. And I think that was very much part of the fun of it is actually being surprised by it. I think that's true to the entire show, but in that episode it is heightened because the stakes are so much higher. I think it's all about the fact that she has lost control and the fact that she has been removed from the place where she has been kind of sheltered and protected from everything else. And actually now being confronted with the reality of what's out there, or her actions have kind of had consequences for the country and stuff. So, you know, I looked at it as a fun ride, really. And for me, what I had in mind was always to try and be surprising with it and try to keep people at their feet. I think, you know, it was a really fun process, I think, to just be literally on the run with them, you know, and see where we'll be taken next. But there was something inherently different about the episode because we're being removed from or the place where we've been grounded, you know. I think that sort of, it was a built-in difference, I think. But I'm glad that you responded to it like that, because it's that was the intent, you know, that's very much what we wanted people to feel like, fuck, we're, you know, not on safe ground anymore. Where is it that they're going to take us? Very much like Elena and Zubarka feeling like they're on the run. What is around the corner from us? How are we going to get away from this?
And as we are wrapping up, I'd like to ask you to a bit of a hypothetical question, because the show revolves around power and what mostly Elena, but basically everyone would do for more of it or sacrifice to keep it whatever it takes. But she just doesn't realize until the final episode what her responsibility is or the effects of her acts are. What would you say is the biggest power you hold as editors is that also entails responsibility while working on a project?
Wow, what an amazing question.
Yeah.
I wanted to go to the bank.
I hope we haven't abused whatever power we have as much as Elena Vernum does. I'm just worrying about her now. I mean, I think this is my first reaction to this. It's a tricky question, and I'll probably wake up in the night and think, why did I say that? I can come up with something much smarter. But I suppose what I think is, on a show like this, you have so many people invested in it who are really smart, really talented people. And it's a really ambitious show. And so it takes work at every stage to get it as good as possible. And one of those stages is the editing stage. So you have a lot of people who are invested in it, who have ideas about how to make it as good as possible. And all of those ideas are going to be fed into the editing room to the director and the editor. And your responsibility is to listen to them and to try them and to give everything a really good shot, while also holding on to what you think the best version of the show is. And in a way, you know, ultimately, I feel almost arrogant saying this, but every bit of editing goes through your hands on the show. Everything that ends up in the show, you've cut it in. And every bit of sound and every bit of music, you've dropped in and sat with a mixer and they've mixed it in and a music editor and cut it in. And so even though there are so many people who's, you know, I'm not saying for a second you're higher status, because of course you're not, than the director and the executives and the showrunner and the actor. But you do have an opportunity to try and execute ideas well, and you have an opportunity to bat them away. And I think, you know, your greatest responsibility is to be open to all the ideas that other people have, but also to hang on for dear life to the things you think are good about the show, and which through the journey you've been on with it in the edit, you know, are kind of, or you believe are worth in one way or another preserving. That's quite vague, but I think my answer would lie somewhere in that area.
That's not an answer that you should ever regret. So,
okay.
It's really good.
I couldn't possibly add anything to that, because it's encapsulates so perfectly exactly how I feel. It's, you know, there is a huge sense of responsibility and of pleasure. Putting it as power, it's like, I don't know, like it's a responsibility more than anything, I think, for me. It's just a huge, and And it's a huge gratitude, I think, to be kind of at that end, you know, to being kind of responsible for sort of really putting it together and respecting everything that came before it. I think it's, but yeah, I think you put it beautifully, Pete. I think it's absolutely, it's absolutely that.
Thank you. Yeah, it's honoring all the work that's already been done and making sure that anything that is sort of passing through your editing machine is getting the best and most respectful treatment that you can give it.
Well, thank you guys so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Real privilege to talk about it.
Our next guest on the podcast is, without a shadow of a doubt, a legend of her profession, having worked on films like Trainspotting, Emma, Layer Cake, or Judy. And today we are going to talk about HBO's brand new miniseries, The Regime, with the show's wonderful production designer, Cave Quinn. Hi, Cave. How is it going?
Oh, yeah. Nice to meet you. It's going well. Yeah, it's good.
We usually like to ask our guests about their core memories that either made them fall in love with films in general or made them go, yeah, well, I'm going to be a filmmaker. I can't wait to hear your answer to this as well. However, a little over 2 weeks ago, I would say, I got to talk to another production designer, none other than Daniel Taylor, who recently worked on, for example, the latest season of True Detective, and who you worked with a couple of times. So I'd like to play a little part of his answer to this question for you, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, of course.
I carried on in film for about 10 years, and then I kind of decided that I should pay my respects to a lady called Cave Quinn, who was the production designer on Trainspotting. And I wrote her an email and said, you don't know who I am, but I've been in the industry for 10 years. And back in the summer of 1996, it was your work that caused huge arguments in my family. And because of you, I changed my direction, my career path, and kind of decided to become a filmmaker. So I just thought I would say thank you and that I am working in film and it would be lovely to work with you. And I've worked with her 3 or 4 times since.
God, that's so funny. That's so nice. That's really nice. Wow, that's so cool. I had no idea. I've forgotten about that. Well, I don't think Dan ever said that to me, actually. That's so nice. Yeah. Yeah.
And what would be yours? And what would be your story?
What would be mine? Well, when I was a kid, like a teenager, you know, the TV was very different. And I used to watch a lot of old films from the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s. You know, on television, sometimes on a rainy day, on a Sunday. And I love these old films, but I never imagined that I could ever be in that world, you know, because there wasn't really a straight path into filmmaking as a child. So I was just growing up enjoying them. So anything from Powell and Pressburger films, they're some of my favorite films, The Red Shoes, A Matter of Life and Death, to Jimmy Stewart films from Hollywood, to Cagney and films from Hollywood from the 1940s, to Busby Berkeley, to, you know, all. I really enjoyed all these different old films and the visuals of them and the stories and everything. So I've always fascinated. And the other, my other key one was Billy Wilder. I love my favorite director, Billy Wilder. I loved his films from comedy to tragedy and everything else in between. So then I kind of went to art school, had no idea you could get a job in the film business. But it wasn't, like I say, a straight path. It was really complicated in those days to think about that career. And I was fortunate enough when I was at art school, I was studying fashion. I was going down that path, that a friend was doing a film at National Film School and he asked me to do costumes on that. So then I got involved in the film business that way. And I just thought I just didn't turn back. Didn't look off over my shoulder. And yeah, that was the moment. And then I did costume for a bit and then decided I wanted to do set design and kind of went back and kind of skilled up on those elements. Yeah.
Amazing.
Watching these old films, loving them, and then having the opportunity when I was younger to jump in there, you know.
Wonderful story. So,
yeah.
And other than the wonderful films I listed at the start of the episode, of course, you worked on many more. But as for the TV side, I saw that even though you are credited for a few in the 90s, and then after about 25-year hiatus comes The Great, Black Narcissus, Pistol, and now The Regime. How did you get back into the world of series, and what was it like rejoining this part or segment of the industry after such a long time?
I think, you know, before all the streaming channels and everything, there's been a renaissance in TV with a lot more content, a lot more money being spent on content. And whereas in the past, you know, when I first started designing in the film business, there wasn't the quality. There's a few quality TV programs made by the BBC, ITV, but nothing like there is now. So that opportunity didn't really arise, I suppose, in some respects, you know, the TV show. And then I remember I did Far From the Maddening Crowd with Andrew McDonald, who I've collaborated with on many films. And I always remember him saying to me, and that was back in 2014, he said, the next big advent is going to be TV here in the UK. It's going to be massive. And literally, this is what's happened. And then, you know, the most brilliant scripts have come through that you really want to do, that I've wanted to do, with enough money to make them look interesting. So, yeah, so that's why I've kind of come back to TV now, is the content. And it's the imagination and budget to make something really special. Yeah, that's why I'm back.
And now onto The Regime.
Yeah.
What was your starting point and general inspiration for the palace and this whole utopian state that's so realistic at the same time?
Yeah, it's basically based on true dictators from the past and from the present. So anybody from Ceausescu and their where they lived to Eva Peron to, you know, Hitler to obviously Putin. So it's all these different kind of types of dictator. And then obviously make it more contemporary. And Will Tracy and Stephen Free as the director and Jess, they wanted to make it set in Central Europe. So it still has Eastern European overtones, but a little bit more kind of in Europe Central. And yeah, the original title for the series was The Palace. So The Palace is kind of like, the, you know, the main character, obviously, Yelena's. But, you know, that, so they kind of started looking at locations, various areas of Eastern Europe, and also in Central Europe, and they realised that some of the beautiful palaces in Vienna hadn't really been used on any TV show in any great, like, you know, great extent. So we kind of went, and I think almost like just as I started on the process, we'd narrowed down like Schönbrunn in Vienna being the starting kind of point exterior. Then we added set extension to this palace as our mate. So we kind of went to Vienna and that Baroque architecture. And then the great thing about doing such an enormous building, it's obviously gone through a few decades of different architecture. So, you know, I could throw in kind of, you know, 1930s where they did, you know, where her offices were have been built. And kind of later on, she says, a revamp for her apartments. So you could throw, and then the disco is more 1980s, 1990s. And so you could throw in all these interesting elements into this one big, massive palace. Yeah, and the whole kind of notion of Yelena, because she is a dictator, she's isolated in her world by her acolytes, and she lives this completely mad life because no, everybody's too frightened to tell her what's happening or criticise anything about what she's doing. Or in the beginning, I'm not going to give too much away, but they're kind of trying to channel her paranoias. So it gives you a great scope for doing something very extreme and quite interesting and different, but trying to keep it within the boundaries of reality as well. So yeah, and Stephen was all in, and Will with it all, for making that kind of like exaggerated mad world. So it was a real gift, to be honest.
this whole look, especially here, is something that you really have to find and get a grasp on. When and what was the first moment you knew you had found the look?
Oh, God, that's a difficult question. I guess I do a lot of research, and then you come back to the colours of her flag, the colours of what she's wearing. Obviously, you know, we use some interior locations as well, so you're aware of those colours. And then it's kind of like her identity was her flag. And, you know, she's always like surrounded by her populist iconography. So that kind of defines her look. And also the other, I wanted to, in her own private space, I kind of wanted her to be slightly more isolated. So I made it darker in her own private space, whereas the rest of the palace is much paler and lighter. Yeah, and the light, working with the DOP, with his LUT, you know, what he's going to be using, how he's going to degrade the colours. That's very important because, you know, obviously some colours change, you know, through this process.
Yeah.
And, yeah, we did lots of work, which we, you know, we've always done this when we were shooting on film or digital. You do loads of camera tests. So you get a really good, and so we built pieces of the set, the colours of her apartment, and we mimics the colours of some of the locations that we're using so we could see how that worked with the costume and everything else. And we photographed the flag. We photographed everything kind of, you know, in a small way to begin with and made sure that the palette was working. So it was, yeah, it was very well thought out. And with the costume designer Consolata, how her costumes worked against the set, that's really critical. So it's almost like we're discussing the flag and the colour of her flag, and then she's discussing what colours suit Kate. And then that plays a part as well, because she's like in every scene practically. You know, what does she look great against? And then you've obviously got the other world, which is Zubak's world. And what is the other side of the palace like compared to her side? And we camera tested all that as well. You know, so all the whole palette was worked out in advance. But, you know, you probably have like a month or 6 weeks development, maybe a little bit longer, just building up colors, palettes, you know, talking to director, showing your references, Consolata, Arwen, the DOP, and Will, of course. And then, yeah, and then you've got the whole world, yeah. And then concepting as well, concepting the, you know, the spaces, right? We've got the costumes in the, you know, her and her costume in the space. So you can literally see it as it's going to be. So it's very carefully crafted every step of the way and thought out.
And you can very well see that on the final product.
Yeah, so, yeah. The other thing that's really important is the scale of the space. She's always in quite big spaces because those palaces are massive, you know. So our sets had to also be reflective, you know, they had to have scale. Mm. That's really important as well.
And you've already mentioned the inside of the palace center where you could draw inspirations from.
Yeah.
What I'd like to get your insight on is the creation and design of the boardroom or conference hall, or I don't even know what to call
it.
With a huge painting on the ceiling, the Putin-like super long, huge desk, etc., which had to portray the power and general politics of this dictator-like person, Elena, while still showing her lack of, I can say, sanity and the whole banality of her reign.
No, the scale was really important. You know, had lots. Obviously, Putin has that real distance. You know, he used COVID as a good excuse, I think, and then he employs it now every day. You know, he always has everybody very far away from him. So they're
you can literally can't touch him. Like there are these videos with his bodyguards where someone just puts his hand on his shoulder and they are already like 2, 3, or 4 of them like so stiff and right there.
So I reference obviously that a lot for contemporary, you know, person in that position. And the kind of things like when he has informal kind of chit chats like with children, and you know, it's like a staged interview And Elaine has got her stage interview with the children. I reference the way he did it. You know, it looks all very natural, but it's not. And she's up on a high podium away from the kids. It's all very staged dancer. You know, all that was just playing. And then in episode five, where we've got the Christmas party, we reference a similar kind of New Year's Eve type of party, which they had in somewhere in within the Kremlin. So, you know, we really had a wealth of quite interesting material to deal with to get that kind of insanity, I guess. But sadly, reality as well as sadly. But that's a great thing I loved about this script. It's so real, but it's also so surreal and tragic. And it's a proper satire on what's happening at the moment in the world, you know, with the extreme right wing seem to be moving in on various governments or have been there for a while. And I think through humour, people can understand what's going on in the world, you know, a bit more, maybe hopefully a bit more clearly. So as well as being a really fun visual TV show, I think it's very poignant of the moment as well.
Yeah, it's just so amazing that this show could get made.
Yeah.
I would really love to see anyone's face from inside the Kremlin just seeing this whole thing, but
yeah,
no chance.
I don't think so. Yeah, no, I think HBO shows that their writing is very good. I mean, Will's a brilliant writer. And obviously, you know, Succession, who's like one of the key writers on that as well. And they do. And Mayor of Easttown, which she did as well, Kate, which is just a brilliant TV show. They do really interesting stuff. So, and as soon as I've read about two pages of the script, it's just so well written and so brilliant. And then Stephen was directing it, who's a genius. And
it really is. In one of the early episodes, we can see possibly a cheetah on both sides behind Elena's desk, plus a mini file folder or paper rack with maybe the same animals on it in the office of the chancellor. And I would guess that this is quite intentional, but...
Yeah, definitely.
But is everything intentional, or do you ever get asked about something where I wouldn't say the audience sees something into a detail of the set that just wasn't your aim or purpose, rather just simply you can't think about everything?
Yeah. I think, you know, because everything was, we did a little, you know, we did lovely location stuff in Vienna. This is actually slightly different, but similar along the lines of what you're thinking. I don't know if it was Stephen intentionally or not, but he had a lot of going up and down staircases all the time. And I think that kind of metaphor, and quite often Will had written things in an elevator, and he said, no, I want it on a staircase. And we used a lot of, because building staircases are very expensive, so we used a lot of really interesting staircases. And that, you know, kind of changed up, I think, quite a lot of how, you know, it was a great metaphor for up and, you know, the corridors of power up and, you know, they're always following her up and down, up and down, up and down. So I'm just trying to think. I'm sure some of the staircases threw up because we didn't design them. They were like in the Hofburg Palace. They were in various other palaces in Vienna. The kind of structure of them, one particular one, led down to the mausoleum, which is really kind of like almost Escher-like. And that, you know, having those locations that kind of just throw in things. For example, we filmed in underneath the Hofburg in a statue tunnel. That was never written in the script. We just found, so I think when you're on location, you find really interesting things. You think, and Stephen thought, oh, I know, why don't we rewrite that? She's not in an elevator. She's walking down this amazing corridor full of statues, which kind of like in itself is its own metaphor of like of everything that's happening in her life. It's stagnated, you know, stagnated old statues just hanging around there with some with covers over them, which wasn't in the script, which adds more value. So I think sometimes with set design, you are considered because you're designing everything from scratch. But Yeah, so that would, I think locations offer more of those instances. But the other thing in the cabinet office with the, you're talking about an interesting perspective that you hadn't really thought of. Alvin, the DOP, thought about the camera, the TVs coming down in the cabinet office. I mean, that was just such a great, you know, and then Stephen, it's just such a comic genius moment. It was the absolute ridiculousness, her in the bath and them sitting around this table. So that set, because we designed it with that dome ceiling, afforded that we could do that. So yes, that sort of, that was the thing that kind of opened up a new moment in a set.
I'd really like to touch on the painting that Elena gets made of Zubak in full armor as an homage to the, to his supposed ancestors.
Yeah.
Versus the one he personally paints and gifts Elena of herself.
Yeah.
And I think this is a really fun detail. And my question to you is rather connected to the latter one. What's it like creating something where the goal is for it to not look good or even look deliberately bad, while your usual goal is to be as close to perfect as possible?
Very difficult, especially his portrait of Elena, that really ugly childlike painting. We literally did so many. Franny, who's my graphic designer, Franny Bennett, who's brilliant. She's a really good artist as well. Mm. She tried, you know, she tried over, I think she probably went through about 10 of different ones, maybe more even, before she hit the right note, because it's either too realistic or not realistic enough, or
just simply too good.
You know, or too good. Or, and then his painting, I worked in Romania with some fantastic people just before I started on this job on a commercial. Mm-hmm. And there's amazing artist stroke scenic artist, George, who's out there. And he's an amazing artist. And so I asked, he did that painting for me. Yeah. And I based it on, sort of medieval kind of Gothic, you know, more contemporary renditions of medieval kingdom that he might, you know, the kingdom that he comes from. I can't remember, sorry, my mind's gone blank, but where the three come from. He did it absolutely brilliantly. He got his face exactly right. And it's kind of good but awful at the same, you know. It's perfect.
Almost everything is in the right place, but at the same time nothing.
It's pretty bad. It's pretty bad. He did an amazing job on that. Brilliant.
You've also talked about the opposites of the inside and the outside of the palace, and taking Elena out of what she's been used to, the luxury of the palace, into the world of the poor, raw and dirty outside. That's a major turn of events, and quite possibly the most important change in the plot of the story and show. How did you even approach showcasing this switch in the narrative in order to reach this level of opposition between the inside and the outside, the familiar and the unknown?
Well, you know, just in the story, everybody is starving. It's a bit like, you know, Korea. They're living on the breadline. They're literally desperate. She has no connection. So, you talk about this with the directors, Jess, Stephen. And then you reference, you know, what you think that, you know, they might be living like, you know, like literally killing animals probably on the street for meat, just living this desperate life. So I looked in lots of photographs of sad, awful things like this, of people's lives living in this way. And, you know, the tower blocks, you know, there's no power because they're in the middle of a war. The house that the character lives in, that who picks her up in the car, he doesn't have electricity. He's using caligas, and, you know, he's using white, you know, or some way of cooking in his flat. So it gets very smoky and dirty. And then with that, we built that as a set. We filmed the exterior actually in London, but it looked very much like a Eastern European kind of concrete tower block. It's a really great location. And then we built the interior. And then actually, when we're in Austria, I bought a lot of furniture there and brought it back to the UK. So it had that kind of nod to that kind of look rather than our kind of our furniture of people have got much money, you know. So there's like all that. So I'd have bought the wallpaper there that we used in that apartment. So I tried to find things that kind of felt from that world, obviously really broken down. So, and then everything, the colour was taken out of it. So her red dress really stood out. Obviously in that room where they're locked up, there's like a blue colour for the wall, which complements the red dress, but like a teal colour. But yeah, we just tried to make everything really, all the colours soak away everything, you know, almost like very degraded, like the world is degraded because they're living like that. So it was great having that contrast for the design.
Maybe this is not really a question, but one of the things that I loved most about the show, that at the end of the last episode, in one of the final shots, we can see Kate Winslet's Elena give her speech from this, I would call it a bulletproof glass box. Is lit from the inside. And I must say, looks really cool, but at the same time, perfectly represents how politicians, ministers, prime ministers, kings and queens, even when they come from an ordinary family and background, say and must say to their country and countrymen how they are their people and he or she is one of them. But once you are there on that platform or even just in politics, you will never be one of them. I mean,
no.
This I'm one of you is maybe the biggest lie a politician can say.
Absolutely. They've never been one of us. And also the whole thing in the whole series, that like the glass box is a bit of a metaphor. Like her dad's in a glass box, you know.
Yeah.
You know, she's transported around when she's in a hyper stage in a kind of plastic box to purify the air. Yeah, it's a kind of a protective shell around her, and that's how they live. Palace is surrounding her. It's not a real world. Yeah, it's a good metaphor.
And my final question is one I asked Pete and Paolo, the editors of The Regime, 2 days ago, which from my experience, they just as much loved and hated at the same time. The show revolves around power and what mostly Elena, but basically everyone in the show would do for more or sacrifice to keep it no matter what. What would you say is the biggest, I know it's not the best way to put it, but power you hold as a production designer that also entails responsibility while working on a project?
I think it's getting the right balance, that you're telling the story, making everything feel kind of in Elena's or Zubak's world without your set design overwhelming the acting, direction, everything else. You're not the thing that's important. It's the collaboration, making the story better for what you've done, but not making it the key thing in the whole show. To me, the more important, the directors and the actors feel comfortable and kind of that's the world that they hoped and imagined it would be, and maybe more, but you're not kind of stepping outside that remit. It's making it a really interesting show because of that. So it's not all about me, basically. It's about the world and the world fits the actors.
Well, Cave, thank you so much for taking the time. It was really an honor talking to you.
Yeah, it's great to speak to you too.
And I'm so glad that we could have you on the show.
I'm joined by cinematographer Alvin Kuchmer, whose previous works include, just to mention a few, Danny Boyle's Sunshine or Steve Jobs, Lynn Ramsey's Ratcatcher, and Joe Wright's Hannah. But now we are going to talk about HBO's brand new miniseries, The Regime. Hi, Alvin. How is it going?
Nice to meet you. Just early morning in LA.
It's nice to meet you too. We usually start our interviews by asking our guests about their core memories that either made them fall in love with films in general or made them go into filmmaking. Can you recall a moment in your life which you can attribute one of these feelings or decisions to?
When I was younger, like 13 or 14, I did drawings, paintings, but also I like comics. I like mostly French comics. Not so much like Marvel comics, more like I thought there were some really artistically interesting French comics. And then I tried to, as a teenager, I tried to adapt the Godfather book into a comic book, but I think I gave up on page 20 or something. And then I was sliding also into photography. Like, I remember, like, you know, I was raised like a Protestant, you know, in Germany, and you've got like this confirmation. When confirmation happens, all the relatives should chip in and you get like a nice big present. So in my case, I was a Nikon FM with a 50 millimeter lens. And I just started to fall in love with it, and I just started to take a lot of photos and experimentation with it. I mean, I did this mixture of, I like photographing people, but also I did experimentations where, like, I put a mirror next to a TV and I put Vaseline on the mirror, and, you know, I just tried to took 100 photos of TV grain on the mirror, you know, bizarre things like that. I was kind of very experimental that way, I guess. I grabbed the Super 8 camera of an aunt and just turned it 360 degrees. I stole it behind her back sometimes and just was filming with it. And then when the family came together and they were projecting the stuff, it was always this, no, who did this nonsense? And it was me who kind of just turned the camera upside down. And I thought, oh, that's really interesting. So that was my early exposures. And then, you know, eventually I did an apprenticeship as a photographer. With a young photographer, he was doing like everything. He did like fashion advertising, industrial photography, which was really good because that means I was exposed to a lot of, you know, to a lot of different styles. And eventually I had a friend who was studying at the film school in Munich. He was studying filmmaking in Munich. And he eventually asked me to shoot this film school exercises. And it was kind of like an RE2C, which is kind of like a camera, which really goes back to the Second World War. It's like a, you know, it's got like a pistol grip, and then it's got like three revolving prime lenses at the front. And I remember I had no idea about what to do with it, really, like technically. So I used my Nikon FM as a light meter. I bolted it on faces and then translated the data to the camera. And yeah, and then he showed me, you know, I remember like first time he shot something, he asked me like to do 20 setups, and I, you know, coming from still photography, I thought, wow, yes, that's a fast pace. That's a lot of stuff. But then eventually he showed me the edit, and I was kind of, you know, not really taken aback by this powerful thing of combination of edit, a picture and sound. And I guess I became very curious about it. I probably watched things like Blue Velvet, you know, which was a huge influence on me. Because I guess I loved that I saw a film where I felt I was in somebody else's head or somebody else's dream. It was so subjective. It was so internal. And I thought that was kind of magical. I guess the first art house movies I probably see was from Jim Jarmusch when I was younger. And I thought, well, that's really cool. You can make really interesting films about your mates and friends. You know what I mean? And it's kind of, you know, away from the mainstream. So I guess these were my early exposures. And then I kind of just, it also appealed to me the collaboration, which, you know, like the people you would meet on film sets. And I didn't know what photography I wanted to do. I remember that my biggest struggle to give up photography was really that as a photographer, you keep your negative and you keep the copyright to your negative. And in film, yeah, I mean, what I found me at the beginning is you do all this hard work and you've got no rights to what you just did. And you know, back then you ended up with the VHS or U-matic. And I thought that was strange to me, but yeah, I guess eventually I got into film school, and I think at film school, you know, it was kind of confirmed that I just loved, you know, I met these super talented people, like a fantastic production designer and, you know, other great people from other different countries. And it was just, I just really liked the exposure to these people and the collaboration you could have and just the influence you would have on each other, you know? So I think that then cemented my love for filmmaking. And how did this experimental approach back from your early days translated into your professional work?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think you can eventually see, I mean, you see different aspects of me in different films. I mean, the experimental side, you probably can follow to films like Sunshine did with Danny Boyle. I mean, like, well, you probably go straight back to Vaseline I was smearing on TVs. And I always loved, you know, I collected wobbly glasses I could shoot through. I mean, I constantly experimented with flaring the lens. And I guess, you know, that experimental aspect kind of went into Sunshine. I mean, you know, on Sunshine, the production designer, we created this giant disco curtain, which was, you know, we had stenciled disc out of plexi, you know, and there were like a mixture of gold and silver, and there probably were a mixture of like 3 inches and 6 inches. And we made this giant mobile out of it. You know, it was like, you have to imagine, probably it was like 30 foot high and 50 foot wide. And it became, and we bounced so much lighting power into it, because also the director, Danny Boyle, he loves visceral filmmaking. So I'm talking about the scene in Sunshine where we are in the observation room, and the story idea was that there's like a glass filter with which you can dial up and down the power of the sun. And Danny really wanted the actors to have a physical reaction to the power of the sun. And also, like, we came up with these macro shots in the eyes, which you kind of see where the iris closes as we came up with the sun. Yeah, so that experimentation led us to this giant disco curtain. And the visual effects supervisor, you know, he kind of embraced it because it was tricky. Back then, most visual effects supervisors wanted it to be in front of green screen, but we wanted it to do in camera because you can't get the same flares in your lens if it's not in camera. So it was the early days of visual effects. And I just remember I thought the visual effects supervisor did an amazing job by marrying what we provided with his visual effects wizardry. You know? So, yes, so, I mean, I think you can see it in films like Sunshine, where I kind of literally experimented up front. You know, I used hand crank cameras and I shot into bendable mirrors. You know, I mean, those flexi mirrors. So, we, you know, in the run-up or the build-up of the film, we just played around a lot. You know what I mean? Like what effects we could create in camera, you know, just to make it interesting within the camera.
Now onto your regime itself. Half of the series was directed by Jessica Hobbs and half by Stephen Frears. Working with both of them, adapting to their different styles and work ethics, must have had its challenges, but at the same time, perks or upsides as well. What is it that you are looking for in order to have a successful work relationship or collaboration with different directors?
Right. So, yeah, that's another excellent question. So, I mean, I guess Stephen Frears I worked with before on a film called The Deal, which was like a quite valuable TV episode about the history between Gordon Brown and Tony Blair. So I kind of had an idea of what he would be like, but also that there has been quite a time gap between that and our collaboration here. So I kind of, just to bring myself into his headspace, I rewatched Dangerous Liaison, you know, like this fantastic film by Stephen Frears. And I mean, you can actually, if you watch Dangerous Liaison, then you watch, I think it's episode 1 or 2, which is very operatic. You can see, you know, the signature of Stephen Frears, which is like, I think he's really a master of developing shots in front of the camera and moving actors around in an interesting way. And he's very succinct. I feel like in what drives the story and what is the rhythm of the scene. So, I mean, currently, I think to him, I think we come at it at very different angles. Do you know what I mean? Like, think about interesting visuals, but for him, there's a rhythm in the language and there's a rhythm in the performances. And he kind of rhythmically develops that into a filmic language, which is, you know, I think Vichy is incredibly good at. And he has got an incredible instinct for it. I mean, unlike Jessica, he doesn't like any crap anymore. So he just wants to do it all on the day. You know what I mean? But he's also super experienced. So he kind of can see on the day he makes decisions very fast. And he's from that old school of he can edit in his head. I mean, he doesn't always has that need of excessive coverage. You know? And then Jessica Hobbs is like, I said yes to the project. I knew it was Stephen Frears. I didn't know Jessica Hobbs at this point, but then Jessica Hobbs joined us on this process. And then we just started to sync each other's ideas up. And it just turned out that we had very similar sensibilities and that I found it very easy to communicate. And I thought she was an excellent mixture between arts and crafts in the sense, you know, she has got substantial experience from things like The Crown. And I just found it easy to communicate with her. Like she just was also a very good communicator about saying what she thought is important about the scene, you know. And so even though they're very, very different, I found it quite easy to work with both of them, if that makes sense. So, like, fortunately, you know. Obviously, I was nervous about, like, well, what was the dynamic between two directors and, you know, us being, you know, working together. And to be honest, the pressure was quite big at the beginning because we were shooting in Vienna. And we were shooting in this incredibly big and expensive location. And we had to shoot out locations, not by episode, but we just had to shoot our location. So what frequently happened that we had half a day with Stephen Frears and another half a day with Jessica Hobbs. Mm. And also the reversal of it. But I felt like both, you know, directors were very conscientious about not eating into the time of the other director. Because what normally happens on the film show is like, well, you might fall behind in the morning on one scene, but you can make it up on another scene. But if you spend the day, you can't. Do you know what I mean? So you kind of have to make a very solid plan. What can I achieve in half a day in this location? But I felt like, you know, I also feel like, you know, our producer Tracy Searle was a very important glue in this kind of, you know, in this mechanism. I thought she was very good at, you know, building bridges and setting the right tone between everybody, you know, for it to happen. So it was a very complex process, but I got to say, I felt incredibly fortunate on the regime in terms of all the collaborators we had. We just had really, really good people, and nobody had like a massive ego overshadowing other people, you know. So it was a very pleasant experience.
The inside and outside, glamour and poverty, plus at one point anarchy is possibly the number one opposition twist or change in the show when Elena is taken out of the palace, out of her regular living place. The difference in lighting between the bright inside, the bright and clean inside versus the dark, dirty outside must have caused some headaches. I mean, sure, I guess it was no sunshine that you just talked about before, but still.
Well, I mean, I think maybe one thing interesting to talk about is, so of course you read the script, right? And these scripts are being rewritten. And so early on the first scout I did with Stephen Frears in Vienna. But unlike Vienna, I think that the writer himself was inspired by Ceausescu Palace. So I don't know who's familiar with Ceausescu Palace, but Ceausescu Palace is kind of, the materials are amazing. You know, he's got marble from around the world, he's got wood from around the finest wood from around the world. And I think historically what happened is that Ceausescu bought all this material, but the palace wasn't built yet when they killed Ceausescu, when they assassinated him. Not assassinated, but they killed Ceausescu, eventually, the people. The history was that they decided they have the materials, that's just might as well finish the build. So, but the building, when I was there, it felt very poor build quality. So expensive material, poor build quality. And it seems to be a constant repair and disarray. So whereas when you go to Vienna, they're in pristine conditions. I've never seen that much gold in my entire life in terms of gold chandeliers and gold on the walls and gold on the railings. And seeing through us, first of all, was said like, oh, we might have to make the gold look dirtier. So, so in terms of my references, also the way I read, when I read the script, I didn't read it the way Kate ended up playing it. Do you know what I mean? So I thought it would be more played straight and maybe more played more serious than she did. So I had in my head, I had like things. I always come back to the trial from Kafka, you know, like these, I always find, I love in black and white, all these faces stand out, but also the environment stands out. And you've got these slightly Dutched angles and dramatic lighting. And then another influence of that early on was, you know, there's a film called, a short film about killing by Kieslowski? Like it's one of the three. The DP is Sławomir Idzia, a Polish DP. And Sławomir always had like this handmade filter. So, it was like dirty greens coming in, a dirty brown oranges, nothing towards the edges. So, first of all, I just thought about breaking the gold, but bringing in some dirty filter elements. But then also, it's also turned out that nowadays you can do it partly in post and it just becomes like, you have to pick your time battles. You know what I mean? Like what can I do over six episodes and how might it change as you go along? It's unlike a film. So, and then when Kate also started, when I saw Kate starting acting it, it transformed it to, it completely shifted in my head of what still applies to my ideas and what I should shift to abundant, yeah, if that makes sense. So, and she played it, really out there. I mean, really like big and funny and bizarre and obscure. I loved it. I thought it was really interesting to me. But it wasn't as straight as I expected it. So kind of that aspect slightly shifted. And yeah, so you kind of feel your way into it as well. I mean, things develop as you go along, episode one, we discussed because in the script it was written that he's very drugged. The Matthias Schoenherz character, Lubak, is very drugged. And I remember having conversations with Stephen. Well, if he's very drugged, how does he, when does drug wear off and how does he, fall in love with her, if he's so drugged, or how do we perceive it? And I guess Stephen didn't know the answers because we have to see how the actors are performing it. So, like in the first opening sequence, my original suggestion was to be really close to Matthias and just reach on to him and just see everything from his point of view. But then also, I guess Stephen quite rightly realized that he didn't want to 100% commit to that because he didn't know how that would develop. So we kind of shot it, some more conventional shots mixed with, those extreme close-up shots. And then in the edit, it became a mixture. So, but now I forgot the original question. What was the original question?
It's okay. I believe the answer was more than good or more than better. So I would just jump onto the next one if that's okay with you. The show's production designer, Keith Quinn, told me that the TV coming down in the cabinet office in the middle was your idea. And my question would be, How often is it that you can have that much say in such creative decisions?
Well, I mean, I think there's also one thing I love about Stephen Frears. I mean, he's an 82 years old gentleman, but he's so confident in and expresses it like, I'm good at that, I'm bad at that. Do you know what I mean? So he's a very good collaborator that way, because he would say to you, Alan, you take care of that. But I'm not good at dreams. You take care of that. But, you know, he's bloody excellent on, you know, setting rhythms and the flow of scenes. So he would also, I just could go to him and said, look, you know, I had this idea about, you know, whatever the TV's coming down. I mean, I can't remember where I got this idea from, but I just thought it would be really funny to see a woman in a bathtub descending. I mean, another idea was of mine was, you know, in the script it said, after this guy sits on Kate Winslet's bed and we think we might try to kill her, you know, she kind of turns a little even more germophobic and anxious, and she wants to black out the palace so that nobody can look in. And I felt like, okay, if I black it out, it's just going to be, everything is going to be lit from the inside and it's going to be boring. And so I said, well, how about if we just use red material instead? So I just like the idea that with red, it would just express your increasing madness. You know what I mean? Like, So red, the color red is almost like a special color for me. It's like I try to make everything less colorful with the occasional madness of red. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like wherever an idea would occur. So I think a good collaboration is based on listening to one another. Do you know what I mean? And kind of understanding what everybody's strengths is and what they're good at contributing. So Stephen hasn't got any issues with like, okay, that's a good idea, let's try it. I mean, another idea of mine was, episode four. So in episode four, there's the scene where where Matthias Schoenaerts, the character Matthias Zuback, is comes out of the prison and has been led back to her in her office. And, you know, the scene was always written so out there and so bizarre that I thought, like, how about if the light changes, you know, like within the scene? And how about, you know, that it's almost like everybody else becomes like a background apart from having a hot light on Matthias and Kate, you know what I mean? So I said, and I remember, like, I said that early on to Steve, and he said, yeah, that could work. And then I spoke to him about it 2 weeks again before, because I had to make sure that he was happy to commit to it, because we had to use sections of the scene out, which meant you couldn't see the ceiling anymore. So I said, no, I'm going to take 50% of the ceiling off. Are you still happy to go with it? And he said, like, I think it's interesting. He said, but you know, I mean, you don't know till the day how that will pan out, you know, in terms of performances. The great thing working with people like Stephen is that he's also, he's willing to be bold sometimes, or, you know, to take risk of committing to take the ceiling out, you know. And then, I mean, another great collaborator is Kate Winslet herself. You know, I mean, she's such a force, and she's so good with, you know, her presence on set. She's just such a great team player. I mean, she's almost like taking care of everybody and being good to the crew. You know, she's very personal with the crew, and she's just like, she is quite amazing. I mean, because she's very, very creative, and she thinks, I mean, she's always, every day she's so prepared. I remember there was a sort of scene, episode two, where she was dapping her lips and putting it into a drawer. And then on the day she said, you know, there's a scene in episode four in which she isn't, not even in, where we see Matthias having collected all her fingernails, and because he's obsessed with her, you know, dapping Kleenexes of lips and everything. And she, on the day, she was aware that, you know, in episode 4, there would be, it would be resonating. So she suggested a close up, you know. So I thought, like, fucking hell, this woman is so, she's so prepared. You know what I mean? Looking things through from all angles. And I think she also had this idea at the, in episode 6 to take, you know, there's a scene with, where she takes all her wigs off. It's the first time. And I think it makes it so powerful. You know, all these episodes, we just see what made up in all these bizarre different wigs and costumes. And then in episode 6, she, you know, she becomes completely vulnerable and exposes everything. And actually, I thought it was a very emotional scene. So, yeah, so she's quite an amazing force. So also what I wanted to say is, so she's got all these aspects, but then she's also technically incredibly skilled of how to turn her head towards the lens, what her angle is, and what, you know, how it would be better with the eyeliner and everything. So she's got it all in a way. She's like very creative. She's technically amazing. And she's just really, it was make sure that the atmosphere is good on set, you know? So, which is important when you do like a 6-part TV thing, you know? So, yeah. And then I had a fantastic relationship with Keith, you know what I mean? Like, my relationship with the production designer was, you know, really crucial because, you know, we try to marry, you know, certain ideas like the ceiling. Do you know what I mean? Like, I have to talk with the production designer, you know, where I say, oh, you know, in that episode 4, I would like to take a ceiling out. Is there any way you can construct it? Do you know what I mean? So I need the collaboration of the art department. And, you know, in the big circular room, do you know what I mean? Like, it's like we're trying to work out, you know, in a way to have the freedom to shoot in a certain way, you have to build the lights into the set. So all these collaborations were really important. And then also, like, you know, like the gym, you know, our collaboration was very good in the gym because, again, I had this idea of covering the windows. But also I knew I had, for both directors, I can't remember, like 1.5 days or 2 days was very tight. So you kind of, you go in there on a practical level, being very aware that you want to approach it in a way that you don't have to relight every setup with big lights. Do you know what I mean? You want to ideally approach it. I always try to approach it in a way that I get interesting lighting without film lights, which because that allows me to use wider lenses, more interesting moves with the camera, and be fast at the same time. I mean, so you kind of try to bridge these different aspects. Yes. So, I mean, so my collaboration with Kate was fantastic. That's all I can think of in the world.
As we are wrapping up, I asked this from Cave and Pete and Paolo, the editors of the show as well, to mixed reactions at first, but in the end, it resulted in wonderful answers. The show revolves around power and what its characters would do for more or sacrifice to keep what they have of it, no matter what. What would you say is the biggest, and I know it's not the best way to put it, but power you hold as a cinematographer, as a DP, that also comes with great responsibility while working on a project?
That's a good question. I think the power is, you should keep your ego in check with power. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think it's about, because also, like, there's so many people who collaborate alongside me. You know what I mean? Like, the, you know, in America, sometimes, like, the DPs are much louder and shouting and, like, faster and everything. And I don't like it so much. And I think, yes, I could probably be louder and shout, but I'm not that kind of person, I guess. And then I try to get really good, surround myself with really good people. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, including these two wonderful operators, you know, one of the operators I worked with in the past, and the other one is a young woman, like Natasha Murren, who also did some second unit stuff for me. I think power is, the best use of power is to empower other people, really. You know what I mean? So I had a wonderful gaffer, you know, like think it's about listening to also what they have to say or what they think is a wise decision to do in a certain time frame. So, I mean, for example, I feel like there was sometimes a point where I thought, oh, you know, I want to use more old school lights and big Fresnels. And then the Gaffer maybe would say, well, yes, that's a good idea, but it's not very time efficient. We have got power problems. I'm taking my electricity problem, you know, on the third floor of Vienna. And why don't we approach it this way or whatever? So power to me is about keeping your own ego in check, I think I would say.
Well, Alvin, thank you so much for taking the time. Thank you for your wonderful answers. And it truly was an honor talking to you.
That's so kind of you. Thank you. I wish you good luck.
And the same to you.